This is Grady McMurtry, Hymenaeus Alpha, reading certain selections of poetry from the times that he's been writing in terms of the order, his own experiences, and his relation with Aleister Crowley, for those of you who might be interested. I have beginning here with the two poems that I wrote, one during the invasion of Normandy while I was there, and the other in the during the Battle of Northern France. I sent them both to Crowley in England at the time. He wrote back and gave me his critique, which was valuable and a bit hard to take. But not so hard to take, I didn't truly appreciate it because he was right. I would realize that in my own progression. I will read the poems and then I'll read the letter he wrote you because I think it explains a great deal about Aleister Crowley, about the great deal about the nature of poetry, and what he calls the geyser of the unconscious, whether we are working in poetry, or painting, or sculpture, or metaphysics, that element of the unconscious, which is our true self, which speaks through us. Normandy in June is, as Crowley observed in his eyes, merely a straightforward presentation of facts seen. To me, it was a deep-felt, poignant, tragic, and beautiful experience, part of the terrible beauty of combat. I will read it as I wrote it. Normandy in June. There is a pestilence abroad upon the land. There is a plague. It is a plague of war, and it leaves a foulness upon the air. It is a sickly sweet corruption of the unattended dead, the dusty smell of charcoal in the cannon-rubble streets. And there are those who live in this pestilence, those who go forward to die in it. And they have known strange things, these men, things filthy and foul and corrupt. And they have known beautiful things, these men, things clean and courageous and magnificent. And they have strange memories, the acid taste of champagne in a metal canteen cup, the lonely graves of soldiers by the ever-teeming road, the tragedy of gliders wrapped around the stumps of trees and bullet-riddled parachutes that flutter in the breeze, dead tankers and burned chariots who look like slaughtered sheep, dead Germans and dead cattle and the guns that shatter sleep. This is the pestilence. This is the plague. And this is Normandy in June. Grady L. McMurtry, 1944. Then we got up to Metz. I'm sorry, we got up to Chartres after the breakout of Normandy. And the great adrenal rush of the compression of time and psychic vibrations that would be the great chaos of the invasion had worn off. And I fell into a fit of depression. This was at Chartres. And I sat down and I wrote a poem called The Cynic. At the age of 63, looking back at the age of 23, I find it somewhat ludicrous that I should open with the line, "The passions of my youth have burned me dry," but that's the way I truly felt at the time, so I'll simply read the poem. The Cynic. The passions of my youth have burned me dry, and unrequited dreams stand in my eyes. They were my hopes, and now they ill disguise my futile gesturings. They pass me by. I would admit no mystery so high as to be sacred from my questing prize. Nor would I seek defeat and compromise, but stood athwart the sky winds. Such was I. The bright-eyed dreams of youth are dead and gone. My destiny is done. My die is cast. Perhaps there will come surcease with the dawn, perhaps. But I have thought that in the past. The wheeling universe grinds on and on. Insensible, insatiate, and vast. Grady L. McMurtry, France, 44. I think the reason Crowley liked the second poem, he did not like the first. I will read the letter. I will extrapolate my own thinking. I think the reason he liked it so much was the last two lines. The wheeling universe grinds on and on, insensible, insatiate, and vast. And I think that gives us a good clue to Crowley's character, Crowley's thinking, and what Crowley was up to in the Ice Age of the Victorian era coming up into our time. He had been alone, and he was faced with a universe that was insensible, insatiate, and vast, that was just wheeling on, and what to do about it. Well, we won't go into that philosophical question, but I will read this letter from him. He addresses it, "Dear Louis." It is typed. He had a typist at the time. This was rather rare. He normally couldn't afford one. "My middle name is Louis." He made a great deal of point of that. He wrote many of his letters to me that. I asked him why. And it had to do with some esoteric thing which was never fully explained, but it had to do with Louis, King of France, and Fleur-de-Lis. I'm sure they all have their place. I think I've spotted some of them since the time. It was just a beautiful compliment. The Bell Inn, Aston Clinton, Bucks, November 13th, 1944, EV. "Dear Louis, do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. Thanks a thousand times for sending Artemis Iota. It took a great weight off my mind. I have been terrified lest, like so many other important things of mine, it has somehow got irrevocably lost. It is very extraordinary the way things happen. I have just heard from a new disciple that he copied with his own hand three bound volumes of typescript which I had written on astrology in 1915. I have reason to believe that was Kenneth Grant, but I have no proof. It was 1939 when he got them." I'm sorry, the typo is either 1930 or 1939. It is unclear here. "I believe there was a fourth volume. How they were stolen and by whom, I cannot imagine. Extrapolation, I think we will find that in a book on astrology by a certain lady who put out two books, but they were put out after she was dead. I've forgotten her exact name right at the moment. We can find it. And the reason that they were put out after she was dead, because she never published Evangeline Adams. Those books were published after her death. They were her notebooks. And if you read them, you will find certain chapters that could only have been written by an English gentleman of Aleister Crowley's vintage. They were presumably his notebooks. The reason why, apparently of the obscurity and his loss of memory, was that she had worked with him either in New York or some such place. They were her notebooks. When they split, she took them. As far as he was concerned, they were his books, but he forgot where they went when he went to Asia or something like that. We believe that it's as simple as that, but of course there's no proof. Paragraph. As I expected, my judgment about your poems is probably the exact opposite of yours. The one into which you put so much hard work, I just don't like. The hard work is apparent. The Normandy of June is not so bad, but it's not really a poem. There is no ecstasy in it, or coming out of it. It seems to me just a straightforward description of things observed. In other words, you did not do any magical work on it. But for the cynic, I have nothing but unqualified praise. As you say, it was just a spur-of-the-moment thing. I damn near threw it away. I was so depressed. And I'm absolutely convinced that all first-class poetry is just exactly that. I said so in the preface to The City of God. I think I have told you I've got the $80 from Jack. I could go on and read this into this, but I think we have the essence of his comment concerning poetry. I believe Crowley to be absolutely correct. He has a great deal of information here about the things of Jack, Wilford Smith, and so forth. But you can read this and put it on tape later if you wish. To continue with poetry, after Chartres, we were heavily involved with the Battle of Northern France heading into the assault on the Rhine. It's always raining in Northern France, especially in the fall, that sort of thing. And so we were headed into the mud war again. Only I was thinking of charging tanks as we were heading into the Rhine. In September, the rains come down. The chalk-gray mud of Gaul is foam beneath the slash of treading tanks and soldiers' curse. I used to like the fall. I will again, I hope. Stand on the banks of flooding streams made rich with autumn rain. The seasoned briar clenched between my teeth and breathe the stinging frost wind. Once again, stride down the tree-laned byways where the heath has mingled scent of sage with fern and pine. To savor there the breath of growing things distilled in ice-chilled silence. This is mine, this time of year when airborne ice makes rings around the Bacchic moon, when sun and tree thrall the wooded land with summer's ember, when these campaigns are but a memory and I am home again in September. Radio McMurtry, France, 44. Between the time of my war poetry and War II, there was a lot of other poetry in between the 5 years, and then there was the Korean War. I wrote quite a long poem on the Korean War, but it is much too, it's a minor epic. I don't think we need to go into it this afternoon, so I'll read some of my space poetry. There was a long stretch of space poetry inspired by science fiction. Here is one. of the Emerald Earth. This, I might add, is, insofar as psychic recall is concerned, having nothing to do with prior incarnations, my psychic impression of the destruction of the planet that I refer to as Adonis, which is the asteroid belt between Jupiter and Mars, and seems to play, according to Crowley, quite a vital role in terms of our appreciation of the cosmic psychic body, since, as he says, beyond there, beyond Jupiter, everything is like above the abyss sort of thing. However, we won't get into that. I'll just read it straightforward as a psychic impression of a cosmic catastrophe in which I had a definite impression of having played a part, but no impression of prior incarnation. It was just simply a poem that came from some geyser of subconscious. Of Emerald Earth. As spaceborne fleets of Viking mariners swing round a world impregnable to jettison each a cargo bomb shattering, irresistible, and space marines with visored helms drop through the black of night with strife that overwhelms upon the atom-shattered rack of worlds at war, so Thetis-sharded Adonis mills round an elder, wiser sun, while asteroids from her scattered hulk rust on the flame-scored plains of Mars. Now must we mark that cosmic war when godmen storm the Titan host with atom fire, lest darkness fall and night engulf the citadel of Emerald Earth. Radio McMurtry, 525-49 EV. Following my space poetry, there was a period of silence, and then I came awake with some very heavy metaphysical poetry. I wrote a cycle of 22 poems, one for each of the major atu of the tarot. The entire cycle is called The Angel in the Abyss, and this from Aleister Crowley's dictum that the initiate only has basically two steps on the initiate path. One, to achieve the knowledge and conversation of the Holy Guardian Angel, which is what we call 5 = 6, and in the yogin practice is called bringing the kundalini up to the heart level. And the second is then, under that divine guidance, to essay the adventure of the abyss. Following that, I then wrote 11 poems, one for each of the major Atu. I'm sorry, one for each of the Sephiroth, 11, because, of course, I included Da'eth. And following that, I sketched down a cycle to be called Rhadamanthus from the Greek god of judgment for a recapitulation of the tarot. But I only was able to salvage one poem from that. And that would be for the Magus card. I'll read that first as a substitute for the long poem on the Korean War, which is called Memo Penciled on a Helmet Skull. But this gives in one page basically the idea. Of course, this was written in the 1960s, long after the Korean War. It's called The Mystical Marriage of the Soldier and the Queen. I am the Virgin of the Queen. Do you accept me? I'm the representative of heaven on earth. Do you accept me? I'm the Virgin whereby all things are accomplished, but I'm not myself changed thereby. Do you accept me? Who accept my burden may never lay me down. Do you accept me? Who binds himself to me can never again be free, for I am all things to all men. Do you accept me? To seek me is to enter upon the holy quest for oblivion, for he must give all that you may attain nothing. Dare you accept me? I am the promise and I am the fulfillment. Dare you accept me? I am the negative in this eternal union of the interpenetration of the opposites. Dare you accept me? I am purity beyond all comprehension of cancellation. I am the balance of the wheel and the fiery feather of my eight. Dare you accept me? Response. There is no holier vessel than a maiden who has become a virgin, for a virgin may attain even under the throne of the queen. Anthem. We are a community of the living and the dead. We are the deathless stars who manifest in a higher state of existence. We are the serpent flower that is death and second birth. We are the next stage of oblivion. Radio McMurtry, June 28, 1962, EV. In the same spirit, but not in poetry, I would like to read you something that I think has been published by Crowley, but may not have been. It's been around. We've had so many of these things in typescript for 40 years, I sometimes forget who published what, or if it's even been published yet. This is called The Legend of the Magic Pearl and How to Do Nothing. He spoke, and his voice was soft music, like the sound of the wind in the trees. Welcome, stranger. What do you seek of me, old man that I am? I come to seek a master, I answered humbly, to find the path to human goodness. I have long searched this beautiful land, but the people seem as though they were dead, and I am as poor as ever. You err somewhat in this matter, said the sage. Strive not so busily to be so very good. Do not seek it overmuch, or you'll never find the true wisdom. Do you not know how it was that the Yellow Emperor recovered his magic pearl? I will tell you. The Yellow Emperor once traveled round the north of the Red Sea and climbed to the summit of the Quinling Mountains. On his return to the southward, he lost his magic pearl. He besought his wits to find it, but in vain. He besought his sight to find it, but in vain. He besought his eloquence to find it, but that was also in vain. At last he besought nothing, and nothing recovered it. How extraordinary, exclaimed the Yellow Emperor, that nothing should be able to recover it. Do you understand me, young man? I think this pearl of his was his soul, I answered, and that the knowledge, sight, and speech do but cloud the soul rather than enlighten it. It was only in the peace of perfect quietude that his soul's consciousness was restored to the Yellow Emperor. Is it so, master? Quite right. You have felt it as it is. Let the body be still, the breath regular, shut off all sense perceptions, silence the emotions, stop thinking. Thus doing nothing, you maintain the union with Tao, which doeth all things. In the OTO newsletter, quite a few of my poetry, some from The Angel in the Abyss, some from Dark Space and Bright Stars, has been published. From Angel in the Abyss. My mind is bleak as the steps of the moon, as cold as the Iranian air. My heart is as hot as the bright side noon, exploding in a solar flare. With the lion love of my fiery boon, I burn in her glorious hair. The galaxies are arrow trees plumed by my eight's bright feather. Our maid's fierce love's a glowing sea that holds the worlds together. January 14, 1962. Her lovely hair. This was for Keter. I wrote it in a woods walking the dog in the winter. Why I was walking the dog is a karmic thing we will skip. But it was a beautiful woods, and it snowed in the winter, and it was sunny in the summer. And the dog was a beautiful beagle who loved to sniff and chase the squirrels and bark. And it was a sometime thing to write poetry. It was in Washington, D.C. Called Her Lovely Hair. I walked the dog in the woods today, and he consecrated the trees. We watched the bounding squirrels at play, crunched the snow in the rustling leaves, and echoed his joyous belling bay down the hollow eternities. Existential modan swaying, star imago, molten attire, lepidoptera unfolding, metamorphosis, angel fire. I walk the woods of the world today, the wood of the ruined towers, where nightside trees in their panic sway to a leer of lethal powers. I saw my skull in a disarray of her gorgon serpent flowers. Diana Archer, maid of light, slayer of the dragon tree, thy beauty's feast, thy serpent priest, burst my head and set me free. Her arrow coursed the bright sea sands and found me in my lair. The universe came apart in my hands, and I praise it, her lovely hair. January 12, 1962. From the same cycle,
Dark space and bright stars. This was for Dice. It's very short, only four lines. Thy serpent priest. In Eden stands thy serpent priest, in space thy serpent flower. The heaven of thy holy lust has burst my casement tower. 4-4-62 EV. From the Angel in the Abyss, Alien Star. The Angel in the Abyss is a cycle of poetry I commend to you highly to read it for technical information because it contains a great deal and one of those vital clues that is true only of true magical operations, that at some point there's what's called, quote, the breakthrough, unquote. After all, that's why you do magical operations, in order to go from one way of thinking or one universe to another, as the case may be, to enlighten yourself or to shift your dimensions. In this particular instance, my poetry from the beginning, from the Star of the Magi up to about the middle, which is Alien Star, which was a psychic impression of the Koth card, the Moon card, what I call the Haunted House or the Freaky House trip. At that point, I ran into something I could only think of as alien. I have never thought of the moon as alien. The moon is the big mother. The moon is what beams down on us and makes us happy on full moon nights and such like that. But I experienced what I had in psychic impression was that I was, as it were, a skin diver in a black wetsuit with goggles on at the bottom of the of a dark pit, like the creature from the Black Lagoon. It was like the Black Lagoon. There was mud there, but I was just above it, and I was just swimming along in this deep, deep pool. But I felt completely alien. And after that, the poetry changed quite drastically, so that by the ending poems, I was writing just almost exactly like some of the current rock music coming out, which is using the same brog prong type of words that I was using in Measure and Meter. But this is where the break came. It was Alien Star, and this was my impression, psychic impression, of the moon card. Alien Star, deeper by far than any star, deeper than the unknown night. The space worm spins its prison bar, its casement tower, height on height, shelled by the abyssal crustacea. Alien Star, alien light, shine upon our alien fright. Alien sun, alien star, shine upon our prison bar. The nematodes in their abodes renew the categories. The scaly reptile in the road seeks on her lunar glories, shelled by the abyssal crustacea. Alien star, alien light, shine upon our alien fright. Alien sun, alien star, shine upon our prison bar. August 21, 1961, evening. And then, to revert to a type of poetry that is reflected in such poems as Nadir. I don't happen to have a copy of Nadir with me, but this is a sort of poetry, very early 1940s, possibly late 1930s, 39, 40, it was someplace in there. I wrote something called The Parish Parson, which I was reminded of recently, and it goes as follows. I have found a place to dwell, a quiet, peaceful part of hell. Far from the heavy traffic sticks, my house is built of lava bricks. And in my nurtured garden grows the black and lustrous leper rose. By Furnace Road lies my abode, close by the Temple of the Toad. And there I live, though not in state. My life is dignified, sedate. Within our peaceful neighborhood live other martyrs of the rude, who serve their master well, and now may share the promise of their vow, to live their days beneath the gaze of him whose eyes with evil blaze. And of my cherished work in hell, I have but only this to tell, that once a week I don my gown, and catch the midnight train to town, to oversee my Sabbath's mirth, and represent our hell on earth, a parish priest for those who feast, and pledge their souls unto the beast. And since I have run out of poetry at this point, but not out of tape, I'll take this occasion to present to Eugene and Helen, specifically for the use of the lodge as they may see fit,
The following Color Xerox representations to remind them of what I look like to Aleister Crowley and what I would look like later. And for your files, and if you would like one. And for your public display, if you need such things, a color Xerox of the receipt from Aleister Crowley for the 50 pounds, that then the Xerox for your files, that would get all of us together and going. And a color Xerox of the two documents of authorization, so that you may display them, and a Xerox for your files, should you need it. I would suppose that I note this, that it seems to be a common occurrence when I pass out this material, it finds its way on the wall. Thank you. That's all I have for the moment, unless you wanted to get into some questions, answers, or reading the Crowley letter or other material I have here for standard Ordo Templi Orientis purposes, if you want to have it on tape. Mm-hmm. Doing the disembodied voice strip. Very well. I guess I better retrieve these. I could have brought so much more poetry, but I wasn't thinking of poetry like this for reading. I'm sorry I didn't know about this. But God knows, what I was thinking of was all of the things I could use, all the things I could turn your kids on to, that sort of thing.
You're so far away from the composition.
Mm-hmm. It's very difficult to sign it. God knows, when I had these half a dozen big double garbage bags, shopping bags like that loaded, and I spent the last few hours before